Welcome back to the World Extreme Medicine podcast. I'm your host today, Owen Walker, digital lead of World Extreme Medicine. And I have with us Marius Rein talking about the Norwegian Air Ambulance. So what we're going to do in the conversation is discuss the anatomy of one of the most progressive HEMS services in the world, that of the Norwegian Air Ambulance. It also goes by the name of NOLAS, and NOLAS are a non-for-profit organization that's delivered critical care for over 40 years. NOLAS employs several PhD candidates to work across various projects, including stroke care, fatigue and sleep, elderly trauma, cardiac arrest, high-performing teams, hypothermia, and much more. They also conduct high-fidelity multi-agency training and governance. And NOLAS are working on a various array of testing of safe flight GPS routes and innovative research projects. And indeed, they have their own bespoke development helicopter and integrated video systems in the dispatch center. So to talk about NOLAS, we have Marius Rein with us. Marius is a consultant anaesthetist working in the pre-hospital division of Oslo University Hospital. He's also a senior research at the Norwegian Air Ambulance Foundation and indeed a professor of pre-hospital critical care at the University of Oslo. Marius is also the editor-in-chief of the Scandinavian Journal of Trauma, Resuscitation and Emergency Medicine. We've done a previous episode on that, so please do check it out on the podcast. And indeed, when he's not at work, he tries to spend time in the outdoors and indeed traveling. Welcome to the podcast, Marius.
Thank you so much for having me, Evan. Thank you.
I wonder if we could just start, Marius, by just getting you to unpack the service provision. So we understand that NOLAS sees approximately 20,000 patients a year and has maybe a different model of flight crew to that in the UK, that of nurses and doctors. Could you just unpack the service for us broadly?
So if you take the macro perspective, the ambulance system in Norway includes a regionally and nationally coordinated service, including helicopters, you know, we call them rotowings and fixed wings, and also including search and rescue aircraft and the rapid response cars, and together they make out a fleet, which is governmentally funded, and it's coordinated through dedicated air ambulance coordinators at the emergency medical communication centers, and also with the main rescue coordinating centrals in Norway. And so the Ministry of Health and Care Services have entered an agreement with the Ministry of Justice and Public Security that allows the national ambulance system to use search and rescue helicopters for ambulance missions when they're available. And we have search and rescue aircrafts situated at 7 locations. And the medical capacity of these search and rescue aircrafts are similar to the smaller ambulance helicopters. So if you focus on the smaller air ambulance helicopters, which is, I'm at the base here in Oslo now, that's where I work, is that the aviation part of that service is put out on a tender. And currently the Norwegian Air Ambulance Foundation, they have a company called Norwegian Air Ambulance Helicopter, and they have the contract for all the helicopters in Norway. And for the fixed wing aircrafts, there is a company called Avincius Aviation Norway that has the tender. And on the helicopter side, we have 14 helicopters at 13 bases, and each base will also have rapid response cars. So that's, you know, the macro perspective. And in 2023, we did in total about 12,600 jobs. And we did almost 1,000 flight hours on IMC conditions, which is quite important to discuss when we have this discussion about air ambulance systems up here in the north. And IMC is instrumental meteorological conditions, you know, weather conditions that requires the pilots to fly primarily by reference to flight instruments. And you know, up here we have 6 months of the year we have more or less darkness because of the Arctic conditions, and we have quite heavy winds and low visibility conditions with snow and fog. And so the aviational requirements for our pilots are, you know, quite challenging. So that's why we have focused a lot on how to manage night flying. So we do quite a lot of that. So the aircrafts are equipped with night vision goggles for every crew member. And we do fairly long jobs. So, you know, the mean mission time for every job is about 53 minutes. And the total mission job is about 1 hour and 26 minutes. So you have a bit of on-scene time and transfer time at the hospital. So it is fairly long jobs. And also we have about 2,300 rapid response car jobs. So that will be jobs in the vicinity of the base, or if you have conditions where the aircraft can't fly, or if you have technical issues. So, you know, that's the big numbers. And we have a crew composition on the smaller aircraft, the ones that I fly in, the air ambulance aircraft. So we have one pilot, one flight paramedic, which is normally an anesthetic nurse with a pilot education and a rescue technical background. So we call that the HEMS crew member. And then you have the doctor in the back, which is normal, which is always a consultant anesthesiologist. So that's the setup for the service.
And just to put that into perspective as well, Marius, Norway, you serve 240,000 islands off the coast of Norway, and indeed 80,000 islets as well. So you've got this vast array of both sort of mainland work and a scattered population amongst that, and then 240,000 islands, of which some are populated and inhabited, some are not. But that hopefully illustrates the geographical demands of the work. It's a vast array of geography.
Yeah, I agree on that. And you have one thing is the coastal side, which is, as you said, scattered with islands. But another thing is the challenging logistics on patient transport is also the fjords, which, you know, shreds the country from north, from east to west, and many of them are very deep as well. So it, you know, it's challenging to transport from the north to south sector because you have to cross these fjords, and also our mountain plateaus, which in the winter time are fairly often they are closed for traffic. So air ambulances are deeply embedded into the healthcare structure and the preparedness structure of the Norwegian society, enabling a scattered population. So in some of the bases, the severity of the patient condition that we see might be not that severe, because sometimes the air ambulances are, you know, a prolonged arm from the hospital. So it might not be GCSO3 and in need of intubation, but you might just be in need of medical assistance, and that there might be some logistical issues in the reason why we use a helicopter.
Maurice, could you speak to the main domains of service improvement for NOLAS and sort of how they indeed feed into improved patient care?
Yeah, so I guess that would be, you know, research, skill training, and innovation. And if we start talking about skill training, we have national HEMS camps every year where we train across different bases to learn from each other and to counteract that you have isolated patterns of work. We have regional major incident management courses. We have training of first responders, and we have sign-off protocols for each base on each category, obviously. And then from an innovation side, we focus quite a bit on innovation, like on the aviation side, where we have, as you mentioned in the introduction, we have something called PINS, which is a points in space, which are GPS certified approaches to different locations. So for an example, if you have a small village and you have a casualty clinic there, and there is no airport, there is no certified landing site, and in order for us to increase regularity, we could decrease the minima by having a GPS approach so that we can increase the safety and increase circularity by preparing for the landing before we arrive there. So we develop quite a bit on these PINS approaches, and they need to be certified by the government. And then we have a weather camera system. So we have an app where we have cameras scattered out throughout Norway. So if you're flying into this mountain area, you can look in front of you by looking at the camera, and these cameras are live feed. So you can see what kind of weather you're flying into, and you can prepare your flights, and you can try to mitigate your weather problems before you're stuck in them. And that has also increased regularity and safety for the crew. And we also work quite a bit on landing sites. So now we have a test project here at my base where we use running rabbits and similar light system that you might normally see in a larger airfield. We have put that into our helicopter landing sites in order for us to decrease the minima, which also increases regularity. So these are some of the innovational sites. And then you have lots of innovation coming into rescue technical procedures and equipment, and also on the medical side as well. And we have a increasing focus on research.
And that's fantastic for a number of reasons. Like you said, the dynamic nature of the weather, it's nice to have, or it's not even nice, it's necessary to have this point in space GPS approach, so that actually you have a collective agreement on, on an approach, no matter what the adverse conditions. And then, like you said, being able to get the meteorological weather from different points which are designated across the ground shares the mental model and shares the flight planning, which is fantastic. Could you speak to some of the research which is ongoing at the moment within NOLAS, and indeed, which is a priority to the service?
Yeah, sure. It's very close to my heart, and we have an increasing research activity coming up now in the air ambulance. And I think it echoes, the ethos about providing evidence-based care, and that requirement also pertains to the pre-hospital critical care environment. And we've also moved quite a bit into not just isolated research projects, but more into research programs. So an isolated project might, in my experience is that if you do an isolated project, it basically just generates more questions. And what we try to do with the programs is that we stick with the problem longer, and we try to triangulate it so we can look at it from different angles, so we can try to find solutions that are not just academically rewarding, but also rewarding for the clinicians and for the patients. So, we have research programs on, mountain medicine, on data capture, data infrastructure. And we have research programs on patient safety issues and neonatal transfer. And, we have on pharmaceutical trials and also endovascular resuscitation. So that would be the main priorities.
Marius, could you speak to the governance structure within NOLAS, and indeed the patient follow-up mechanisms in place to learn from the pathology you're treating, and indeed the resultant interventions once they're in the hospital?
Yeah, sure. You and I, we work together in London's Ramblers, and in the UK, you have a very solid governance structure in place. Whereas here up in the north, there's more Viking to us. We're more autonomous up here in the wild north. So we tend to do a bit more, just whatever we feel like. But I think we're coming to it now. But although the governance structure is less structured than we saw in London, we do have case presentations on a regular basis. We do have D&D meetings with hospitals, and we have crew debriefing. But I think the major difference would be that all the doctors working pre-hospitally in the air ambulance service are consultant anesthesiologists, so that the need for a case-to-case, the formal need for a case-to-case review is less inflicted upon us, given that we're all specialists. But, a specialist can always learn as well. So I think there is a big need for governance, even though you are experienced.
Absolutely. And I think, like you said, there's things you can learn, not only from patients, but actually from other subject matter experts in within their field. Marius, Nolus have been known for actually their approach to progressive stroke care, and no less through the research, but also through innovative action, you know, CT scanners and the like. But could you speak to what's happening within stroke care at the moment within Norway?
Yeah, I think, you know, not just Norway, but, you know, in globally, I think that one of the major differences is that stroke is now recognized as a time critical condition. But the major problem would be to differentiate a stroke, which might have, you know, a very heterogenic pattern of a presentation, so that the in-hospital clinicians can recognize it and initiate the treatment. And in order to mitigate that, we have a research program on that. We call the Pre-Hospital Brain Program. And what they're working on now is a lot of issues pertaining to structured communication from the pre-hospital field and recognition of stroke. And we have dispatch video so that the dispatchers can look at video from the scene in order to try to identify stroke. And we also have studies looking into more structured communication between EMS staff, ambulance staff, and the in-hospital clinicians using apps and training programs. And so that you can identify the stroke and you can try to differentiate whether this is a bleed or if it's a clot, and to see whether these patients should go to a neurosurgical center or if they can take into a stroke center for treatment, either medically or by embolectomy. And in order to do that, we also need to look at how we can transfer points of care diagnostic tools to the pre-hospital environment. And one of the things that we're looking into is if it's feasible and technically possible to have a pre-hospital CT scanner. But we're also looking into biomarkers and other interventions as well.
Fantastic. And like you said, you know, there is a real time pressure on stroke of various pathology, really. And what's interesting as well within the research is that the archetypal 4.5 hour window is also being called into question as to whether that's truly a definitive marker or not. And could you maybe speak to how you use simulation, low or high fidelity simulation within NOLAS to the benefit of the staff?
Yeah, we do use simulation quite a bit in different stages. You know, we have simulation as part of sign-off. So, you know, take myself for my sign-off, for example, we used aircraft simulators, you know, the ones that you use for pilot training. And in the simulator, we could also put on virtual reality technology so that the doctors can sit in the back and they can train on fixed rope operations, under the slung operations that we train for and we use. And then we can put in scenarios that you can't use in a real life setting, like tail rotor failure, etc., etc. And all of these things are trained in a simulator. But we also use simulation here at my base. We have a quarterly training regime so that every 3 months change the training so that we can have focus on, because we have seasonal challenges, you can have one quarter focusing on avalanche, one quarter focusing on drowning, one quarter focusing on the search and rescue, etc. And so that's, you know, and then you have different types of simulation workups for us to go through. So there's a structured system that covers, you know, the majority of the things that we might go through in a year. So that before we go into avalanche season, we will have trained on avalanche technique and search techniques and safety issues. And then we come into the drowning season, we have trained on that as well. So it's quite a bit on that. And we also have, you know, here at my base, we are participating in a REBOA trial. So we use REBOA for medical cardiac arrest. And then we have a REBOA gym So we have a dedicated space in our base where we have mannequins and all the kit is out there. So it's very easy for the clinicians when they are on a shift just to go over there and train and do the procedure. And then they could just leave the kit and they'll sort it out. And so it's a low threshold for training. So, I guess that would be, some examples on how we use simulation.
Like you're saying, removing the friction to training is excellent, because you almost want that muscle memory in all situations, but deeply embedded from maybe hours and hours of training and having that kit available all hours of day. Could you speak to one of the fundamental components? I mean, it's fantastic that you even use a flight simulator to orchestrate sign-off, because one of the components that unites HEM services really is that of human factors training, non-technical skills and human factors training. And it's everything which you can't necessarily get from a textbook, which is applicable in the pre-hospital environment. Could you speak to Nordis's approach to human factors training?
Yes, we have a dedicated aeromedical crew resource management instructor course, so that everyone's working operational side to air ambulances in Norway have to go through a full day ACRM training every year, which is mandatory. If you don't do that, you can't fly. And on these courses, we focus on all the different challenges that we could meet in a aeromedical CRM environment. Could be in command gradient, or could be visual issues or fatigue management, et cetera, et cetera. And they change the topics every year, so we can have, and that's normally based on data, so that we can see if we have a year where we have lots of safety issues pertaining to light on skid landings, which is quite dangerous. We train on that. And if we have more issues coming into conflicts in cockpit, we can focus on that, and et cetera. So that's, human factors training is definitely recognized as something that's very important, and we focus on it, and we look at it when we recruit personnel to see that they have a solid CRM base, and so it's part of selection, and it's also something that we talk about, because we try to debrief the majority of the jobs we go to. And then one of the things that we try to assess is whether we actually work together in a sufficient way.
So looking at the commitment to research that NOLS has, they have a dedicated research helicopter, which is amazing to see. Could you sort of speak to how this has assisted service development in the past, and indeed how it benefits patient care?
Yeah, sure. We have an Airbus H145, a five-bladed version, which is an amazing aircraft. And it's very similar to, so it's now part of the fleet, but it's also now a research dedicated machine. And it enables us to do projects, outside the normal preparedness, so that we can install technical equipment, sensors, recording equipment, etc., inside the aircraft, knowing that it's not being called out on the job in 2 minutes. And so we use it for projects like, validating pins approaches. We are heavily involved in developing procedures for winching operations. So it's got a winch to it, and currently we're doing fixed rope operations now, underslung operations. That's it's a paradigm shift if we move on to winch operations, and all of this is facilitated through the research helicopter, which also use a more research-like projects where we do reasonably did a project where we did testing out now 5G technology. Where we can have live streaming of ultrasound images from the aircraft to a radiologist at the hospital, so that they can help out diagnosing fast exams or whatever. So it's a tool for us to do, and we've done canine rescue dog training, etc., etc.
So, Marius, you mentioned previously about Nautilus's approach to cardiac arrest and through the research where, you know, where you're testing boundaries. The Robur arrest trial sounds super interesting, actually, for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Could you, a medical arrest, actually, could you speak to just a high-level description of the trial and what you're hoping to sort of get out of the trial?
Yeah, sure. You know, so Robur arrest trial is a multi-center randomized control trial looking into the use of Robur, resuscitative endovascular balloon occlusion of the aorta, in medical cardiac arrest. So the study is looking into whether it's feasible and if it influences ROSC rates in addition to standard advanced cardiac life support. So in adults in medical cardiac arrests. So what we do is that we attend to scene and the patient is randomized either to intervention or control. And then because we do individual randomization, not the step register or block randomization, and we then established advanced cardiac life support. And then if the patient is in the intervention group and is not in ROSC, then we put in a Robur. And in principle, that can increase cerebral perfusion pressure and coronary perfusion pressure because it's a zone one Robur, you know, meaning that's very high. And then we look if that basically increases the ROSC rate.
Also, isn't the same disruption of vessels that you'd see within trauma? So there's almost an intact vasculature which you can attack or indeed intervene on, which almost hopefully makes the success of the intervention a lot higher. Could you speak to the Neotrans initiative that you're looking at and indeed collaborating with Oslo University Hospital?
Yeah, sure. You know, so we neonatal surgery and neonatal care is regionalized, and the majority of the neonatal diagnostical processes are done in utero, so that we are aware that there is a baby with a problem. But some of them are born on an island or in a fjord or somewhere that they shouldn't have been born, and then they need to have transport to hospital. And the hospital that does the predominant amount of surgery, you know, for cardiac correction and similar, is here in Oslo. So these babies need to be transported in a quite, you know, challenging physiological state to our hospital, and we do that as anesthesiologists. So we do not have a neonatologist with us when we do this. So if you work in the base here in Oslo, you need to be trained for neonatal incubator transport, and then you do it on your own as a part of a three crew team with the pilot and the HEMS crew member. And this practice is, you know, it needs to be evidence-based. So what the Neotrans program, research program, is looking into if this is safe, what is the consequence of transport on the neonate. You know, transportation involves noise and vibration, temperature change, G-forces, etc. And many of these patients might be very small. I recently transported a patient of 600 grams, and you know, it's very small. So it's we need to have a structured approach on how to do this in order for us to improve on all parts of this, and in order for us to validate if the stuff that we do is actually safe. And so at the moment we're doing quite a bit on epidemiological studies to see what we're actually doing to establish a pattern, and then we're also doing controlled stress monitoring of the baby to see what actually happens before, during, and after transport on stress markers. And you know, this is a huge topic and it's complicated, so this is the reason why we have a program, because we do have about 20 or 30 minor projects coming together in this research program that might, you know, triangulate these conditions that we might improve care in the at the end.
Yeah, one final research project that we could maybe shine a light on is the pain management and indeed pain relief project you're looking at, which is the pre-Mifen. So it's, if I'm right in thinking, inhaled methoxyfluorine with intranasal fentanyl, and the comparator to that study is IV or intravenous morphine. Could you maybe unpack this, the background, and indeed what it could mean for analgesic regimes if it's successful?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think oligoanalgesia is a major problem. I think that many of the patients that we see prehospitally do not have optimal pain control. And one thing is that this is obviously devastating for patient comfort and experience, but we know also that this has negative influences on the outcome of the patient. You know, it increases stress and might be a driver for cytokine release and similar. So it's very important for us to have pain control. And currently, a lot of the tools that we have available might not be that effective, because the majority of them require IV access. And then some patients, IV access takes time, might be difficult to achieve. So that's why we're looking into, on a randomized controlled trial, comparing three regimes. So we were comparing inhaled methoxyfluorine, which is normally called Penthrox, which I guess is a drug that is being used many places of the world, I think especially in Australia. And then we compare that to Instanil, you know, intranasal fentanyl, and IV morphine. And so the study has just been finished, so we're not recruiting patients to the randomized control now, and we're just looking into the data. So but what we see is not just, you know, us doing research, but what we try to do is to open the box and try to use the most appropriate method as possible for us to establish causality. So we try to do it in a randomized interventional study. And previously, we did a lot of observational studies, but now we're moving into randomized controlled trials, which is a completely different ballgame.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And from a robustness and hierarchy of evidence perspective, it's far more rigorous, but also probably a lot more nuanced and complex in its in the deployment of that. Certainly, as a critical care paramedic, I used to, because it can be very traumatic getting IV access on a 4 or 5 year old child, just the process alone, never mind how difficult it might be. So you're right, the endpoints and indeed the second and third order effects of just far less invasive pain management sound fantastic, and it would be great to see what the fruition results of that study show. Mm-hmm. Marius, as we just come in to land on the conversation, could you maybe just speak to just some salient take-home points for listeners, just aspiring to align to the ethos of continual improvement? No less is known for continual improvement and to be sort of continually striving to improve. Could you maybe speak to some of the take-home messages or mindsets that you employ?
Sure. And I think one of the main things that we need to strive for is to have equal access to healthcare, so that people should have access to good quality healthcare fairly quickly, regardless of where you live. And that's also a political issue, you know. So if you want to establish a diversified inhabitation pattern, you need to have a service that can provide equal access to healthcare. And an air ambulance would be definitely a tool in order to achieve that. And so these patients should also be met by someone that practices an evidence-based medicine. So as you mentioned, you know, we borrow small parts of in-hospital medical specialties like obstetrics or gynecology or infection medicine or surgery or anesthesia or traumatology, etc. And we all put them together hospitally, but that's not a reason for not doing it in an evidence-based way. So we need to provide evidence for what we do, because evidence is also a way for us to establish harmful patterns and for us to learn and to do high quality, better care. So, and by doing that, you know, having regularity, having safe practice and having evidence-based care by high quality and motivated people, I think you can establish critical care without walls.
Listen, that's fantastic. And I just want to thank you for your time today, Marius. It's hugely insightful. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.